The third case of the day BMD versus Fidelity and Deposit Company. Okay. Ms. Gibson?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Brandy Gibson. I represent BMD Contractors, and we're here today to ask this Court to reverse the entry of summary judgment in favor of the defendant, Appellee Fidelity Deposit Company of Maryland. The District Court held that Fidelity Deposit as a surety was allowed to avail itself of what was arguably a pay-if-paid clause in its principal's subcontract agreement. Fidelity and Deposit's principal was Industrial Power Systems, who I'll probably refer to as IPS today, and IPS entered into a subcontract with BMD Contractors. IPS had a separate contract with its contractor, which was Walbridge Aldinger. So at the end of the day, kind of the scheme of where the contractors fell was owner of this project was Getrag. Getrag contracted with Walbridge. Walbridge contracted with IPS. IPS contracted with BMD.
And the surety only involves the IPS-BMD relationship.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the bottom line today is that the surety, the bond, the payment bond in effect in this case, does not have any non-payment provision in it. So the two primary issues for today, first of all, the primary one, is whether a surety can avail itself of defenses in its principal subcontract with the claimant when they're not included in the payment bond. And our situation deals specifically with a pay-if-paid or a pay-when-paid clause. So the ancillary issue is whether that provision that was in the subcontract between BMD and IPS was actually a pay-when-paid clause, which would shift the risk of the owner's non-payment from IPS to BMD, or whether it was a pay, or I'm sorry, which would not shift the risk, or whether it was a pay-if-paid clause, which would effectively shift the risk of the owner's non-payment from IPS to BMD. So I'll start with that issue. In the subcontract between BMD and IPS, there is language in there that says it is condition precedent that IPS be paid by Walbridge, before it's required to pay BMD. It's an issue Indiana has not addressed. There is no case law involving pay-when-paid or pay-if clauses in Indiana. However, I think both BMD and Fidelity and Deposit agree that Indiana would follow the majority rule, which is set forth in the Sixth Circuit decision in Dyer versus Bishop. In Dyer versus Bishop, the case involved contractors, much like our scheme, where the bottom-level subcontractor was not in a contract with the owner. It goes subcontractor, general contractor, owner. And the court in Dyer really hammered on that if you're going to shift the risk of non-payment by owner to the bottom-level subcontractor, it has to be explained in unequivocal terms dealing with the possible insolvency of the owner. In our subcontract, there is no language regarding Getrag, you know, that the risk would be shifted to BMD for Getrag's non-payment. Doesn't talk about the insolvency of Getrag. It's simply, it is condition precedent. And condition precedent, it means what it means. However, when Indiana law, as we believe they will apply the Dyer rule, the Dyer rule requires more than that. The Dyer rule requires that there be unequivocal terms dealing with the possible insolvency of the owner, which isn't in our subcontract.
Well, isn't that just in the nature of a safe harbor kind of a recommendation on the part of the court? It doesn't require language shifting the risk of insolvency, it requires clear language on the part of the subcontracting parties to shift that risk downstream. And the condition precedent language in this subcontract seems to be quite clear that that's what's being done. Why isn't it enough to use condition precedent language?
I agree it has to be clear language to evidence the intent of the parties, but I really think that what the court is saying in Dyer is that this is such a huge shift of the risk that it has to be more, I mean, the clear language has to include dealing with the possible insolvency of the owner. And the cases that have interpreted that, they only find a pay if paid clause if that subcontract deals with the possible insolvency of the owner. There's a case out of, I think, the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, Sloan versus Liberty Mutual Insurance Company, out 2009, that actually held that the mere presence of the condition precedent term in a subcontract is not enough to get past, to shift the risk from the owner or from IPS to BMD.
Well, the clause in Sloan was a pay when paid clause, wasn't it?
The court held that it was a pay when paid clause because it had, even though it had a, I believe that was maybe like a 30 days timing, but then it also went on to say that it shall be a condition precedent. So in that case,
the 30-day, which is characteristic of a pay when paid clause in these kinds of construction contracts, the pay if paid just uses the condition precedent language, and it may or may not be accompanied by the shift of risk of insolvency language, but the cases don't hold that that additional language is necessary to construe one of these clauses as a pay if paid clause, just that that would conclusively demonstrate that it is. But the condition precedent language seems to me to be enough.
That is the distinguishing feature between Sloan and our case. I think in our case, if you combine the fact that it didn't deal with any terms involving the possible insolvency of the owner, coupled with the fact that the IPS BMD subcontract referred to the IPS Wallbridge subcontract, and in the IPS Wallbridge subcontract, there was very specific, it's kind of the boilerplate classic language to shift the risk of owner's non-payment. And while that in and of itself may not construed together make the terms of BMDs ambiguous, I think when you also consider the fact that the IPS Wallbridge subcontract also had language in there, I mean, it was a reimbursement type contract. It said before Wallbridge pays IPS, IPS has to pay their subs, and they have to furnish, I think the term was sufficient proof or something to that effect, before they receive payment. So we're talking about the IPS BMD subcontract that says, that arguably may have a pay-if-paid clause in it, and you look at that compared to the IPS Wallbridge subcontract, which is incorporated in the IPS BMD subcontract, and it says Wallbridge or IPS doesn't get paid until it's paid BMD. So when you take those two contracts together, even if you find that the condition precedent language alone would be enough to constitute a pay-if-paid clause and shift the risk, when you take that with the other subcontract together and the fact that it requires IPS to pay BMD before IPS receives payment from Wallbridge, then that's...
Which contract is that?
The IPS Wallbridge contract.
Okay, well, I guess I'm looking at this, IPS contract, it's got a lot of paragraphs, the one I'm looking at. And one of them is sort of obscure, but it's on page 45. It's a contractor may withhold payment from subcontractor in whole or in part for the same reason and under the same circumstances as owner may withhold payment from contractor. Well, the owner withheld payment because of bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm. All right, and are you referring to a provision in the IPS BMD,
yes,
or the IPS Wallbridge?
Well, I guess it's you know, whatever this country is. It's IPS. It's IPS that is the letterhead. I guess that's what I'm.
And I think no matter what, I think what you're getting at is there's a flow down provision.
A flow down
provision. And the district court
what
didn't.
What do you call that?
FLOW.
I know. Is it what is slow?
Flow.
Or flow.
F as in
yeah,
Frank.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what is that? What you call that? A flow down provision.
That's part of it. That's what I'm sure Fidelity and Deposit would call that. It was something that was argued in our summary judgment briefs. It was not. It was not decided by the court yet because of the pay if paid. But I think what you're probably getting at is BMD and its subcontract with IPS. Assume the responsibilities that IPS had to Wallbridge.
Well,
that's an argument. So when you do that, though, you also have to look at the fact that that's what the IPS BMD agreement says, but the IPS Wallbridge agreement, it says something different. It says IPS doesn't get paid by Wallbridge until IPS has presented sufficient proof that they've paid BMD. So that's the difference, and I think when you take those two together, that renders the pay if paid clause.
A subsequent payment? When we're talking about the flow, if that's what it is, I mean, you take IPS doesn't get paid by Wallbridge until it can show that it paid BMD?
It doesn't. Yes, it doesn't have those.
I don't see how, and unless it's a subsequent payment. You know, we paid them $1,000, and now they should have paid that to BMD, and if they haven't paid that to BMD, then we're not going to make the next payment. But that's not what you're saying.
My review of it, the way I read it, was it's a reimbursement type. They front the, I mean, they don't
they're
get,
fronting
they're
it.
Fronting it.
So that means IPS has to front it to BMD in order to collect from Wallbridge?
That is what we believe the IPS Wallbridge agreement says.
Which paragraph in the Wallbridge IPS?
I believe it's on page 142 of the appendix, our appendix, and it should be in the.
Which one's yours?
Maybe you can give me a.
It should be.
Rather than an appendix page.
It's on the second page, I believe, at the bottom of the second page.
Which one are you?
Is that in the remedies or the payments clause?
The payments.
Payments clause.
I'm referring to the IBS or the IPS Wallbridge agreement.
Which is the thicker one?
The thicker one would be mine. Probably.
It's yours.
Yes.
Okay. So you thought on yours. And what page?
It should be on page 142 of my appendix. And to answer your question, I believe it's in both. There's a section titled progress payments, and there's a section titled final payment.
I just see one payment section, Article 22.
And
are we looking at two different things?
We might be. Are you looking at the IPS BMD subcontract?
Wallbridge IPS.
It was on the. There's more pages than just those two, but it was on the second or third page.
Okay. I'll find it.
So this is Exhibit 3 on page 142 that you're talking about.
I believe so.
You think so?
I think so.
Cool. So that's all I got.
My memory, it was page 142.
Name on it. You've got Wallbridge, you've got Industrial Power Systems, and everybody's on here. It's pretty sketchy. I don't know what line you're talking about. Is it somewhere after page 142?
It might be on 143 or 144. My memory was it was the second, the bottom of the.
I don't expect you to memorize this.
Well, the bottom of the second.
It
was at the bottom of the second. What I believe was the second page of the agreement, and the top of the third. There was a section that talked about progress payments. It had four or five paragraphs. It was at the very end of that, and then the section below was final payment.
It's pretty small print.
It is.
Yeah.
You want to reserve? I don't want to cut you off, Ms. Gibson. Do you want to reserve? You're into your rebuttal.
I'll do that. Thank you.
Mr. Christ?
Judges, I'm Tom Christ, and I represent Fidelity and Deposit Company of Maryland, who I'll probably refer to as F&D. They also represented Industrial Power Systems, IPS, below, and the Getrag Liquidating Trust ultimately sold the building that's at issue in this dispute. I'd like to pick up where I left off before I get to the argument that I had planned. There is nowhere in either of the contracts between IPS and Wallbridge or IPS and BMD that you'll find any terms that required IPS to pay anyone, including BMD, before it received payment from the upstream party. It's not in any of those agreements. This is not a cost reimbursement agreement. It is a standard contract through which a contract, in this case, IPS, would invoice on a monthly basis, as a contract requires, for its work and the work of its subcontractors. When it received payment from that work from the upstream party, Wallbridge, the project's prime contractor, it was then required to pass payment downstream. Okay, well, there are no other conditions in the agreement.
What was the term of art you just used for the kind of clause that
cost reimbursed? Oh, cost reimbursement. Yes, this is not a cost plus or a cost reimbursement contract.
So that would be where the contractor is fronting its subcontractor's costs.
That's correct. And were that the case here, we couldn't be here because BMD would have been paid.
Okay.
All right, so what we're really here about is that, you know, every contractor's and subcontractor's worst nightmare is, what if I do my work, do it well, and parties upstream from me can't or won't pay me, which is what happened here. You know, Chrysler and Getrag filed for bankruptcy protection within 6 weeks of each other and stopped a nearly million-square-foot construction project in its steps. The job was 80% complete, as is agreed to by the parties. No utilities, couldn't be occupied, and the building just sat there. Up to a few months before that, payments flowed as they were required to flow, owner to Wallbridge to IPS to IPS's subcontractors. When the owner closed up shop and filed for bankruptcy protection, IPS, just like the other subcontractors, just like BMD, had some work in place at that building for which it had not been paid, for which the payment had not left the owner's hands before it filed for bankruptcy. And when that happens, which is certainly not unheard of for an owner to run out of business, or run out of money, or go out of business, the parties have to look to their contract for what they do in that circumstance. It doesn't become a free-for-all. You look at the terms of your agreement. The first thing the parties have the right to do in Indiana is to record a mechanics lien, and they all did. There were 200 of them, IPS, the bond principal, and BMD. The question here is, if recordation of that lien is not enough and subcontractors are going to have some amount of money, which they will not receive for good work that's in place, what can they do? Well, here, there are three, not one, not two, not three, not hidden, not sneaky, not in an appendix, three pay-if-paid provisions in IPS's subcontract with BMD. One of them is on the first page of the agreement in caps and bold. That was not my emphasis. That's in the document.
That's a condition preceding claim.
Absolutely. And that is really, in this industry, as all of the cases cited by the parties disclose, those are the key words. Those are the magic words. You know, there was a time 40 years ago where pay when paid provisions first came into to use in construction contracts. They weren't called pay when paid provisions then because there was nothing to differentiate them from, as there is now, a pay if paid provision. Contractors originally installed provisions in their agreements that indicated, I will pay you, subcontractor, 7, 10, 14, 21, 30 days after I receive payment. And that was intended to be, as the case law discloses, a condition precedent. But what happened was contractors attempted to use them, as those provisions, those timing provisions, as complete bars, attempted to argue in a number of these cases, well, if I have to pay you, subcontractor, 7 days after I get paid and I never get paid, I'll pay you 7 days after never, which is also never. And courts ultimately throughout the country said, nice try. That's not how that's intended to work. When you have a timing provision, there's a representation made that at some point in the future, you will be paid. You complete your work, my obligation as a contractor to pay you has been triggered in time. And if I never get paid, in a pay-when-paid timing provision, at some point, the clock runs out and I have to pay. And the states are all over the map on what a reasonable amount of time is if your contract says payments due 7, 30, or more days.
But they're generally unanimous that that kind of a provision doesn't extinguish the obligation to pay.
The courts are virtually unanimous that that's the case, and that's why the second branch of these exculpatory provisions came about and split this way.
When you say states all over the country, what law are we operating under?
We're operating under Indiana law here.
Why does it say someplace it's Ohio law?
IPS's subcontract with BMD had both a venue provision and a choice of law provision, choosing Ohio law as the applicable law and Ohio as the venue. Those provisions are not enforceable in Indiana. Indiana has a standalone statute that provides if you build it in Indiana, you litigate it in Indiana pursuant to Indiana law, regardless of what your contract provides.
So that's why all the parties agreed Indiana law applies.
That's why we're in Indiana. Well, and the case that was cited here by counsel, the Dyer case, 1962 Sixth Circuit case, great pay when paid case. And that's actually the first time that a court explains you have to look at the plain reading of the contract to determine whether or not this is a potential permanent bar or a delay mechanism for payment. And that's really the birth of the pay if paid provision. The magic language with pay if paid, which is the other branches of cases that fill these briefs, is when the words condition precedent are used. And it's not a subtle difference. It's a massive difference. In one, the pay when paid provision, the contractor completes his work. The subcontractor's work is complete. He's invoiced for it. The obligation for the contractor to pay him triggers right then. The contract then provides some time, process paperwork, for the payment to flow downstream. Pay if paid is very different. Here, there was never an obligation of IPS to pay BMD a dollar until IPS was paid for BMD's work. And they did that, and that's agreed to in the briefs. Over $4 million was passed month after month after month in this job from IPS to BMD as IPS was paid. But when the money stopped and IPS wasn't paid for those last 2 months of BMD's work, it's entitled to rely upon the condition precedent language that's contained in three different places in its contract. And more so, to have both a belt and suspenders, IPS did include in the BMD subcontract what's commonly referred to in industry as a flow-down provision. It's also used in other areas of law, of course. A provision that indicates that IPS is incorporating the entirety of its contract with Walbridge, the prime contractor, into its agreement with its subcontractors. Counsel agrees, counsel for appellant, pages 13 and 14 of their brief, there is a flow-down provision in the BMD IPS subcontract. That provision does incorporate the entirety of the prime contract between IPS and Walbridge.
Is that the one I quoted?
It is. It is, Your Honor. In addition to that, appellant concedes in their brief that there is a fantastic pay-if-paid provision in the IPS-Walbridge prime contract because it has some more language in it in addition to condition precedent. With that agreement incorporated into the subcontract between IPS and BMD, that should put the nail in the coffin about determining whether we have a pay-if-paid conditional promise or whether we have a pay-if-paid provision in the agreement. The whole second part of all the parties' briefs, presuming we find a pay-if-paid provision present, is whether a surety can stand in the shoes of its principal when asserting the defenses contained in that principal's contract. And you were favored with dozens of cases from jurisdictions all over the country about this issue. None of those cases stand for any proposition in Indiana other than that a surety stands in the shoes of its principal, can assert all defenses available to the principal, period. Even new cases, when we look to other jurisdictions who have more law on pay if paid, because there are none in Indiana, we look to West Virginia, New Jersey, and Kansas. Those three federal jurisdictions have identical, those states have identical suretyship law as Indiana. When each of those courts have been confronted with a pay-if-paid condition precedent provision in a construction contract being asserted by a surety, each of those courts have allowed that to occur. They've indicated Indiana law dating back to 1898, the oldest case cited in our brief, states the surety stands in the shoes of the principal. The surety's liability is coexistent with its principal. It's secondary to its principal, and it can avail itself of all rights and defenses of its principal that it's guaranteed. There are no cases cited in the appellant's brief to contradict that with respect to settled Indiana law. The only case that attempts to touch on this cited in the appellant's brief is the Culligan case. It's an old case. The fact it's old is meaningless. We've cited much older cases. However, Culligan came down from this court, not interpreting Indiana law, and at a time when there was no such thing as a pay of paid provision. This court also didn't touch upon any suretyship issues in that case because there was no dispute about whether conditions to precedent had been met. So the utility of the case is significantly limited, as was recognized by Judge Pratt in the trial court.
Maybe hypothetical. Did they finish this project ever?
No. Ultimately, in the Getrag bankruptcy filed in Detroit, the court created a liquidating trust of essentially a consortium of over 200 contractors who hired counsel and others to market, sell the building, and to discharge the proceeds to all claimants. I represented the liquidating trust. All parties have received about 50 cents on the dollar for their claim, including IPS and including BMD. And to conclude, I'd like to add that, you know, IPS is very much making a what's good for the goose is good for the gander argument. It's a subcontractor, just like BMD is a subcontractor. IPS is Wallbridge's subcontractor. IPS has not sued Wallbridge for money on this project that Wallbridge has not received associated with IPS's work for one reason alone, because there's a pay of paid provision in their contract that prohibits it from doing so. The only party who has disregarded that provision and who has gone out on their own, ignored their contract, and attempted to pursue IPS for payment that we all acknowledge it did not receive is BMD.
The principal in the Culligan case was, in fact, liable.
Yes.
Anyway, so that's a distinguishing feature of that case, apart from the fact that it preceded the rise of these pay-if-paid clauses.
Agreed.
So are these bonds and these subcontracts standardized in the industry? Is there some sort of a trade organization in the construction industry that standardizes form subcontracts that recommends the use of certain language?
Yes and no. On federal construction projects, there is a standard federal statutory form. Each state has its own statutory form, so most sureties use a fairly benign generic form, which indicates names the work that's being covered, that is covered by the bond, and identifies the contractor sometimes by name, sometimes project by name, but there is no standard language that is used in the 50 states.
That's with respect to the bond,
yes,
itself, the language of the bond. What about the construction industry and subcontracting language?
Yes.
Are there standard industry forms that are used that have this pay if paid, pay when paid clauses,
yes,
and you pick and choose?
Yes. The largest entity that issues documents used in the construction industry, standardized documents, is the American Institute of Architects. The AIA, every 5 or 10 years, issues a new set of documents pertaining to these kinds of relationships. Every one of them in the past 25 years has contained either a pay-when-paid provision or if paid, or a pay-if-paid provision. Today, all standardized forms issued by the AIA have a pay-if-paid provision. There are some other organizations, such as the Associated General Contractors of America, who issues a separate document. It mimics the same pay-if-paid language. You know, this language was not made up by some smart lawyer or some smart contractor. It was a judge who identified the concept of condition precedent also applies here. So that is why the magic words condition precedent have been contained in these contracts. As a result, and in conclusion, F&D would ask that this court affirm the lower court's decision, make it the law in Indiana, clearly the law in Indiana, that if you express that payment to a contractor for a subcontractor's work is a condition precedent to the obligation arising to pay downstream, that they need not, and that a surety, as has been the case in Indiana for the last 100 years, can stand in the shoes of its principal and assert that defense.
Thank you, Mr. Chris. Ms. Gibson?
Thank you. The difference between IPS and BMD and all the other contractors is there was a bond here to cover payment in the event IPS couldn't pay. That's the purpose of a bond, is to provide payment when the contractor doesn't pay.
So in the event that the contractor is liable and doesn't pay. That's how sureties work.
In Indiana, the surety law, we would agree with Mr. Chris's assessment of that. However, Indiana law is also that you look at the surety, the contract, the surety, the terms of the bond. And when you look at the terms of the bond, the fact that the non-payment language is not included in the bond, that's why the surety cannot avail itself. The other reason, and the fact that distinguishes all the cases that Fidelity and Deposit have relied on, is that allowing or taking the position that the district court did and deciding that since IPS wasn't liable because of the pay-if-paid bond, then the surety's not liable, that would contravene the Indiana mechanics lien statute, which says you cannot have a provision in a contract that waives your right to make a claim under the payment
this
bond.
This isn't a lien waiver case. This is a surety case, and a case interpreting pay-if-pay or pay-when-play or paid language. It doesn't have anything to do with lien waivers.
If I may respond. The Indiana mechanics lien statute, it says that a provision in a contract requiring a claim or a claimant to waive the claim under the payment bond is void. In our case, it's essentially an indirect waiver. We're never going to be able, a subcontractor that has a pay if paid clause in their subcontract is never going to be able to make a claim under a payment bond, and that's tantamount to waiving. I mean, those words, you know, BMD waives its claim under the payment bond isn't found in the
It doesn't prevent you from filing a lien against the owner.
It doesn't, but that's not our sole remedy. This circuit in Colligan held, you know, at the end of their case, said, you know, Transamerica, the surety company, might want Colligan go file a lien against the property.
Right, but that's what the statute prohibiting waivers of liens is directed at.
It's not only waiver of liens, it's an anti-waiver provision for claims under a payment bond as well. That's the difference. Thank you.
Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. Court